What's going on, everybody? Jared Sandler here with you, welcoming you to another episode of the Justice Set Conversation. We've got episode 64 right here for you, and it's not often you get a chance to speak to an absolute giant, a legend in this person's respective sport, but that's what I was fortunate enough to have the chance to do in speaking with the Hall of Famer Mike Singletary. He obviously first made his name on the professional scene with the Chicago Bears, a part of that unbelievable 4-6 defense that helped the Bears to a Super Bowl. One of the greatest linebackers of all time. Before that, he went to Baylor, so there's the local connection. He lives in DFW. Most recently was coaching at the high school level after being an NFL head coach, and who knows what the future will hold for Mike Singletary. But I really, really love the chance to speak to Mike Singletary. I mean, my goodness, you know, you talk about one of the greatest in his sport. Mike Singletary certainly deserves that sort of characterization. Just a reminder, would love for you to subscribe, like, comment, or just share the link. Copy the link and text it, email it, to whatever, to a friend, someone who is a big Baylor fan, a big 49ers fan, a big Bears fan, whomever might be interested in hearing from Mike Singletary. Would really, really appreciate it. But without further ado, here we go. Episode 64, the Justice Set Conversation with the Hall of Famer, Mike Singletary. All right, Coach, I understand you grew up with a lot of brothers and sisters. So what was it like growing up in, a pretty big family?
Well, I'm the last of 10 kids, also the smallest of 10 kids, and really the least talented. It was tough. You know, Mom and Dad really did the best that they could to make things work and to keep the family going. My dad was in the construction business. He was also a Pentecostal pastor, and my mom babysat different families around the Houston area, and that's kind of how we made it. My brothers worked with my dad, and you know, that was kind of our job, and that was kind of the way we made it.
You said you're the smallest and the least talented, so I gather some of your siblings were also quite athletic?
Yes, my brothers were very athletic, as well as my sisters, but we were not allowed to play sports. I got a chance to play sports when my dad and my mom divorced when I was 12 years old. And at that time, there was a window for me to play, and I begged my mom to let me try to play the game, and you know, she agreed if I didn't get hurt. I crossed my fingers behind my back and said, "Okay, I'm good with that."
So, at 12, was football the sport you wanted to play most, or were there other sports that you were interested in?
Football was by far the most important sport in my life. I watched football, and I wasn't really. I had to sneak and do that. Sometimes I'd miss church on Sundays and say I was sick so I could watch the Cowboys. The Cowboys was my favorite team growing up, and Roger Staubach was the player that I loved dearly, and the way he played and the way he carried himself on and off the field. That was really the one of the biggest reasons I really enjoy football and love football. So it was early on, I really loved football.
I imagine you've gotten the chance to chat with Roger at some point.
Yes, I have.
And did you relay the influence that he had on you?
Yeah, I remember the first time I met Roger. It was about maybe 20 years ago. And I met him. He was working out at one of the clubs, and I just had a chance to tell him how much I really appreciated the influence that he had on my life, and I really tried to pass that on in my own life, to always try and conduct myself in a way that would make my mom proud and would make God proud, and that was the thing that I always wanted to do.
One of the things I read, Coach, that you lost two of your brothers when you were growing up, and you at an early age had to deal with hardship in that category. How did that influence you or shape you during those formative years?
In terms of when you mentioned my brothers, would you ask the first part of that question again?
Yeah, I read that you lost in separate instances. You lost two of your brothers, I think
yeah,
one of
okay,
whom.
Okay.
Yeah, and I was just curious how that influenced you and shaped you with how close you were to your brothers.
My first brother I lost when I was five. And even though I knew him, I didn't know him as well as the next brother I lost. When my mom and dad divorced when I was 12, my brother Grady, that same year, within a six-month span, when my dad left, right after that, my brother Grady came back home, who was next to me in the family line. And, you know, he was kind of the man of the house, and he was helping my mom. Everything that he made, basically, brought it home to my mom. And we kind of were making it as a family. And then just a few months later, my brother was killed in an automobile accident. And that really rocked my world. That I thought at that time, what in the heck is going on? I mean, Dad walks away. And then, okay, my brother comes back home and he's helping out financially. And then we look like we're making it as a family, my mom and my brother, myself and my sister, Rudell. And then the next thing you know, he's in an automobile accident. And 3 days after that, he's dead. And I, at 12 years old, I just made up my mind that, you know what? Life is not fair. And, you know, I've seen two people do the right thing. My mom really try and fight for the marriage and fight for the family, and it just didn't work. And I saw how painful that was for her to deal with. And then losing my brother, Grady, I thought, you know, he's trying to do the right thing. Mom's trying to do the right thing, keeping his family together. And both of them, you know, it just seemed like they lost. And I thought, you know what? I'm not going to strive to do anything great. Life is too painful to go all out and do everything and give everything that you have only to come up empty. And I thought, if that's the way life is, then I'm going to take the easy way out. And I'm just going to stay mediocre. I'm going to stay in the middle. And that was the decision that I made until my mom walked in the kitchen, and she realized after my brother's funeral, just a few days after that, I had made up my mind that this is kind of the way I'm going to live my life. I'm just going to kind of be on cruise control. And that day, my mom walked in the kitchen, and she challenged me. She said, "Son, I want you to sit down. I need to talk to you about this thing called life." She sat me down. She said, "Son, I want you to know that life is tough. It's not easy, but it is what you make it." She said, "I want you to know that greatness is in you. It's in you, son. And it's in a lot of people, but they quit. And I'm challenging you, don't quit. I'm asking you to get up, dust yourself off, and get back in the ring and start swinging. And, son, you just got to keep swinging until one day you're the only one left. That's what life is all about. When you get knocked out, when you get punched in the gut, when you get sucker punched, you gotta find a way to get up, get back in that ring, and keep fighting. And that's what life is all about." And then she asked me the question that changed my life. She said, "Son, I need to know if you can be the man of the house. You know, I need your help. Can you help me? Can you do that?" And when I looked in her eyes, I knew that she believed in me. She really believed in me. And I said, Mom, I can do that. And I got up from that table, and I walked in my room, and I got out a sheet of paper, and I wrote out my vision statement. And on that vision statement, it listed like this: find a way to get a scholarship to go to college, get my degree, in which I'd be the first in my family to do so, get drafted and go to the NFL, become an All-American, get my, you know, buy my mom a house, take care of her for the rest of her life, become an All-Pro, go to the Super Bowl, and own my own business. That was my vision statement. I wrote that out, and I put it on my wall, and that became my boundaries in life. Anything that somebody offered me, anything that came along, I don't care what it was, if it didn't match up with that, then Mike Singletary wasn't going to do it. And so that was for the next for the next few years, that's what got me to college, being able to see that vision statement every day and get on my knees and pray and say, Lord, I need your strength. I need your help. If I'm going to do this, the only way I'm going to do it is you got to help me. And that was the effect that my brother had.
That's amazing. I appreciate you sharing that with us, Coach. And it seems like, you know, I guess for everyone, we have memories growing up that we remember every detail because of how influential it was. And it seems like that conversation with your mom and what transpired right after, I guess for you, is one of those memories that you'll never forget.
Absolutely.
That's amazing. Now, it seems like that vision statement, you were able to check everything off, and along the way that meant going to Baylor and playing for Grant Taft, who I know, I believe, at least I read, that you had a great relationship with. Why Baylor? Were there other schools in the mix, or was Baylor the school that you just kind of set out and that was where you wanted to go?
Well, that's an interesting story. Baylor was the only Division I school that offered me a scholarship to play linebacker. The University of Texas also offered me a scholarship, but to play fullback, and fullback only. And that made the decision very easy for me, because I knew that linebacking was the thing that I loved. I loved hitting people. I loved being able to find the football and track it down. That was the thing that really excited me about the game of football.
When you look back at your career, I don't know if it was in high school or maybe it was at Baylor or maybe it wasn't until you got to the NFL, did you have, similar to that conversation you had with your mother that kind of put you on the path to success, was there a conversation or a series of events that took place that helped you really grow and understand what it meant to be or what it was going to take to become a great player?
It's very interesting. I always was able to find someone in my life at every stage of my life, whether it was a coach, whether it was a teacher, whether it was a professor. But I always found someone who was doing what I wanted to do or knew how I could get where I wanted to go. And I say that in high school, there was a gentleman, his name was Durfee Thompson. And when I first started playing football, even in high school, I played well. I was doing what I did but everyone kept saying that I was too small. They just said, Mike, you know, you need to change your position. You're not going to make it. You play good, but you're just too small to play at the next level. And so in my junior year in high school, there was a gentleman that had just gotten cut from a football team. I think it was the Kansas City Chiefs. He was a rookie. He came out of Prairie View A&M, just outside of Houston, and he got cut from the football team his rookie year. And so I was in my classroom, and some of the guys, my teammates, came and got me and said, Mike, you got to come see this guy, man. This guy is huge. And he just got cut from the Kansas City Chiefs. And look at how big he is. And you think you have a chance to play linebacker? Look at how small you are. This guy got cut. And I remember leaving my classroom and going down with my buddies or my teammates to see this guy. And when I saw him, there was something in me, and it was like, wow, this guy got cut? I mean, he looked like a Greek god. And, you know, but I walked away from that thinking, man, it really is going to be tough for me to make my goal. We were just starting spring training in high school in my 11th grade year. And Durfee Thompson was at that practice. And I practiced, you know, the way I normally did. And you know, as a kid, when I wrote out that vision statement, I used to go outside and run and pray and ask the Lord to give me the strength to reach my goal. And when I did that, I always said, Lord, if you bless me to get where I need to go, I'm going to give you everything I've got. Everything I've got. I'm going to give you everything I've got on the field. I'm going to give you everything I've got in the classroom. I'm never going to cheat. So I practice like it was my last practice every time. So Durfee Thompson saw me practice that one day. He was there at that school one day, and I had a chance to meet him. And after practice, he came up to me, and he said, I saw you practice today. And he said, you have it. You got it. He said, if I had what you have, I would still be playing. He said, next year, somebody's going to offer you a scholarship. Take it and run with it. And I thought, wow. And so I asked him, I said, so what do I need to do? I mean, it created an excitement in me. It was like a breath of fresh air. And I'm thinking, why is he telling me this? Why is he saying this? And how in the world could he say, I have it, and he's so much bigger than me? But I had a belief in me, but meeting him just reassured me. It was a great word that day. And he gave me a couple of exercises to do. And so he was like the first guy that I met that set me on the right path, that gave me that one word that gave me all the courage that I needed to going into that senior year. And so it was very exciting. And it was guys that I met like him. I always was able to meet a coach. I always was able to meet another player that was able to give me, kind of keep me on the path of this is how you get there. And so those men in my life were very reassuring, and they were like, you know, connecting the dots to help me get where I needed to go.
That's amazing. On the coaching side, who is the person who kind of filled the same role as far as helping you to grow and learn in becoming a coach?
That's interesting. There's no coach that spent more time with me than Bill Walsh. When Bill Walsh found out that I was going to be coaching, because after I retired from football, it was 10 years before I started coaching. I wanted to make sure that I raised my family, and my wife and I had a great relationship before I did any coaching, because I was so focused when I played. I didn't even know how focused I was until I retired. And when I retired, all of a sudden, I saw things in my kids and my wife that I never saw before. And my wife was always saying, Mike, you know, you're at home, but you're not here. And I'm thinking, what is she saying? That makes no sense to me at all. And so I didn't get it until after I retired. So, but when Bill Walsh found out that I was going to be coaching, he called me and he said, I want you to come out here, San Francisco. I want you to come and let's go to dinner. And I want to talk to you. And so I met him there, and we met about three or four other times. And he just talked to me about the things that I needed in order to be successful. And when I had the opportunity to do this and do that. So it was really interesting. I talked to Coach Parcells, spent some time with him. Dan Reeves, I spent time with him. These men were very gracious to me and sitting down and talking to me. Pete Carroll, talked to him. And so it was really, really interesting, but a number of people that I talked to, but those guys come to mind right away because, they were just, they told me things and taught me things that I'll never forget.
If a young person came to you and was curious about the coaching world, what would you, and I know they're, probably it's tough to boil it down to one thing, but what would you say is most important to understand in order to find success as a coach?
I would say the most important thing would be, first of all, learn everything you can. And what I mean is not just from sitting down, looking at film and sitting down and being able to draw a play and things like that, but really have the ability to do both, be able to draw it up, but also be able to go outside and be able to make a player better, be able to take a player. I don't care who he is. You know, I've had coaches say, this guy can't play. I say, give him to me. And I work with the kid and, you know, next thing you know, the kid's an all pro. And say, well, man, I didn't think this kid could play. Well, you know what? And it's not like I'm magical or something like that, because certainly I'm not. But you have to have you have to develop the gift of teaching, as well as the gift of teaching in the classroom and teaching outside. That's the thing that I would tell every coach: don't just settle for what you know mentally as a coach and be able to draw it on the board. The thing is, at the end of the day, can you make that player better? Can you take that player outside or even in the classroom and just say, hey, let me move all the chairs out of the way. This is what I want you to be able to do. Can you do this? And instill within that kid the confidence that he needs to go out and be a great player. To me, that's what I would tell him. You know, learn both sides of the game. Learn all three phases of the game. Learn all four phases of the game, whether it be offense, defense, special team, and then also the game that nobody really sees, but it is the clock, making sure you understand the rules of the game and the clock.
I think, you know, what strikes me about any leadership form is that oftentimes you're asked to lead a bunch of different people. And, you know, football's no different. You're dealing with different personalities, different backgrounds, you know, different interests, different goals. What was the biggest challenge and maybe also the biggest key in being able to connect with different types of people when you're in that position of leadership, whether, Mike, it was when you were playing with the Bears and you held leadership roles there or in your various coaching stops?
I think the biggest thing I learned as a player, being a leader, you know, I was the captain of every team that I've ever been a part of. And it took me a while to really understand that in order to be a captain, it's not just about telling players what to do. It's not just about giving orders or telling a guy, hey, you need to do this, or hey, you need to stop. It's being able to make an investment. As a player, I had to do a better job of making an investment into those guys around me. When I was a player, I was so focused that sometimes I really didn't know the dreams and goals of those guys that I played with. You know, we played together, and I made sure that they knew, hey, I want to be the best. I want to be great. I want to be the best that ever played. And so I exemplified that every day in the classroom, on the field, wherever it was. But I didn't know that much about them. I was just kind of telling them, hey, this is what you have to do. And it's kind of like I was saying, you need to do your job so that helps make me better. And so I really had to learn how to be more of a servant as a player to serve those guys around me and help them understand that we're all in this together. That's really, really valuable to a coach, to be able to have leaders on the team that's trying to accomplish the same thing that he wants to accomplish, but they're speaking it in the locker room. They're speaking it when the guys are out having a drink. They're speaking it when you're just spending time with guys playing cards or something like that. But the message is always being conveyed, not only in the conversation, but how you live. As a coach, learning to be a leader, it was different. It was quite a bit different. I thought when I became a coach, well, these guys know as a player, when I start coaching, I understand what you're going through. I understand that, you got to work and how hard it is and how selfless you have to be. You know, because I know where you're coming from. I used to be in the same place, but it wasn't like that. As a coach, I really needed to understand that I was no longer as trusted as I was as a player. I was still separate. And when you're on that sideline and you're only on the sideline and you can't cross that white line and go out there and play with them, there's a difference in the way you talk to them. There's a difference in the way you have to express yourself. And when I first started coaching, it was like, hey, man, look, I want you to do it this way and I want it that way and only that way. You understand what I'm saying? And I had to understand, wait a minute, you gotta change that. You don't have to change the message. You have to change the tone. And so I had to learn that as a coach. And that's something that's been a real blessing to be able to see and make that adjustment. But those are the two styles of leadership that they're basically the heart of it is the same. But it has to be delivered differently.
Okay, I read that you love to cook. Is that true?
I will cook. I don't love to cook, but I will cook.
Okay, do you have a special dish?
Yes.
What's the main dish on the menu?
The main dish that I cook, and I can wear it out now, is called smothered chicken, green beans, and smothered potatoes, cornbread or hoe cake bread, which is like biscuit bread. That is a meal that I can put on, and you will love it.
What time are you serving it? Just let me know where I need to be. I'm sold.
You can understand there's a lot of starch in there. I cook it about once a year.
Coach, thanks so much for taking the time to chat with us.
Thank you. God bless.
Well, there you go. Episode 64 of the Justice Set Conversation. Thanks so much for taking the time to tune in to my conversation with Hall of Famer Mike Singletary. Again, it would really appreciate if you would subscribe, like, comment, share. Any and all would really, really appreciate it. We've got more Justice Sex coming your way, plus other content that you can find on the channel. Just look around. We got all sorts of interviews and commentaries, hopefully stuff that you'll enjoy. Until next time, stay safe, be healthy. We'll talk to you later.